Hello there. I hope all is well with you. All is not well with me, however. My computer just crashed. Totally crashed. And it just happened. So my screen is just black. Nothing is showing up. And that includes my notes, and that includes my run sheet for the program today. I tell you, I mean, when things go wrong with me, they really do go wrong. So we shall see how things will go here as I kind of reach back into my memory and if I could recall what it is I wrote for the program today. I tell you, it's amazing. Okay. Well, what I wanted to talk about was really going back to the program yesterday and build on that. That's what I had planned to talk about today. But truly, I don't have my notes, so I'll just have to recall it from memory. I'm talking today about the situation that we're in, and we're in a pretty precarious situation because all hell, I think, is breaking loose everywhere that we look, and there seems to be very little in the way of a solution at the moment. We are simply caught in this vortex of insanity. And beyond that, we have no way really of controlling anything or influencing anything. We are just caught in this vortex. It's just swimming around and around and around, and we are going along with it because there isn't any, we have no infrastructure, no architecture, no way of operating effectively on our own. We that would allow us to how should I say, to stop this madness that we are surrounded in. Oh, I'm hearing some other stuff going on here. Let me just do this for a minute. We have no way of affecting what's going on in Washington. We have no way of compelling the system to respond to us in a logical way, or to respond at all, even in an illogical way. We just have no way of, on our own, of making things happen the way they ought to happen. The situation is maddening, and we're just there. We like, you know, a piece of flotsam and jetsam, as they say, floating along with the current. There's nothing there to allow us to compel the situation to move differently, to move in a different direction. It seems to have a mind of its own. It seems to be catering to people who have unique access to the throttle and brake of government. And we are just out of it. We are on the periphery, and we are observing what's going on without having any real power to change things. It's very scary. Well, you know, we talked about yesterday that this budget now has been moved to the House for a vote, a finalizing vote, in order to initiate the federal budget for the new fiscal year. But lo and behold, something has happened. And what has happened is that they have found that at the last minute, apparently, Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee managed to put in, to slide in, a couple of provisions that weren't there before. And these provisions apparently would affect, in a very positive way, it would give him one heck of a windfall, because he, like Donald Trump, has vast holdings in real estate. And the provision that appeared suddenly in the budget from its way from the Senate to the House came with this new provision. And this is very maddening, and it's very upsetting, but it's, in my view, very typical. We've seen this happen quite a lot. This is how Obamacare got passed. The bill went before the Congress literally in the dead of night, and it was passed that way. This bill, relating to the new fiscal year, with its $1.5 trillion more than had been anticipated, added to the national debt. But the move by Corker angered a lot of folks, because, first of all, that was not supposed to happen. And secondly, Corker initially had said he wasn't going along with this budget, although he's a Republican, that he was not going along with the budget. He had a history of antagonism toward Trump. And all of a sudden, he likes the budget. So he's now in favor of the budget bill. And it's supposed to be so maddening to fellow Republicans and to Congress in general that these kinds of corrupt things are still happening. But the whole budget is corrupt, really, if you look at it that way. The fact that a budget was constructed minus input from the people, both sides agreed, the Democrats and the Republicans both agreed that we need not be involved in this. All we need to do is to bear the brunt of this additional cost of $1.5 trillion, which everybody accepts as an underestimated budget. They think it's going to be more like $2 trillion added to the current deficit, and this is not good news. But this is how politics is being done in the United States. This is the way it has been done for a very, very long time. But that doesn't make it right. And that doesn't mean that it should continue to be this way, where you have people, just a small group of people, 535 people, 100 in the Senate, 435 in the House, making decisions arbitrarily and without any consultation that we can believe in that is legitimate, but making highly political decisions, and we can't do a thing about it. We have no access to this process at all. They go behind closed doors, they work out their deals, and in this budget package are several smaller packages that cater to specific interests. And in this case, we see Bob Corker acting in his own interest. It happens to be a provision, as they said, in criticizing this move, the surprise move, the stealth move of putting provisions and constructing a budget that specifically caters to these highly influential special interests and their own, of course. So we talked about how opaque the process is, how undemocratic it is, how corrupt it is, the way this process goes, the way it has been happening. And this has been happening under Democratic administrations and Republican administrations. Again, you may recall how critical I was about in explaining Obamacare and why, in fact, Obamacare had so many flaws in it. It was that from the very beginning, it grew out of the heads of the Clintons. Hillary Clinton, for example, just called up a bunch of people together and the healthcare industry behind closed doors. She had no authority. She had no power. She just simply assumed the power of a secretary of health. She had no authority to do this, but she was allowed in secret to come up with what eventually became Obamacare. And the people involved were people she personally selected, and they came up with a health care bill that they liked and that suited their interests. There's big money in health care. This is how it was done. And then when the package was prepared, basically they handed it to Barack Obama and said, here, you take this now to the end zone, carry the ball, get it passed. And that is why this bill, Obamacare, was passed in the dead of night. People had under less than an hour, in some cases, to actually read this bill, which constituted several thousands of pages. And that's how that bill got passed. This is a problem that we have. We have renegade governments, and they do whatever they want to do, and they, on the basis, they know exactly who is going to foot the bill, but they also know who they will allow to join them in making a lot of money. This is one of the unprosecuted crimes, I think, for the Clintons and President Obama. He agreed to undertake in getting Obamacare passed some of the most outrageous, some of the most outrageous actions in terms of the democratic process, small d. The democratic process should have been that legislators should have had great input. This was a bill, I'm talking about Obamacare, should have been brought to the people. It should have been discussed in much greater detail. All these bills that are part, that end up being part of the national budget, these things cannot be left just to 500 people, 535 people. It just should not be allowed, because it is open. This is an open crime going on. This is organized crime going on. This has nothing to do with democracy. It has nothing to do with fairness. It doesn't even have anything to do with logic. You know, this is the ongoing crime in Congress, and we, the people, end up having to foot the bill. Now, it happens that in this case, in this fiscal year that they're trying to get this bill passed for, that people have a great need to protect this new president. As you know, he came in and upset the apple cart and got elected. And he got elected on the basis of a number of promises and that he was going to kind of clean house. He was going to make America great again and so forth. But they're following the same old crappy system that they had in place, where special interests are the people who get to write the nation's budget. This budget, none of the budgets in the past decades, none of the budgets got written by a process that would be open and people will know what's going on, what is being considered. All we get to know is that, you know, there are cuts that have to be made, and they usually are made not to upset the upper classes and the rich, but they uniformly are made on the backs of working people and the poor in this country. And they call them now the middle class, whatever that is. But there has not been a process in decades where people are apprised. The people are apprised of things that are being considered and why they're being considered and the priorities of the budget and exactly what kind of debts are being incurred and the reasons. You know, we have massive allocations to the military. You'll have massive allocations to special interests. And not necessarily in the interests of the people at all. This is the one thing that we have experienced over and over again. Like I said, whether it's a Democratic administration or a Republican administration. Now, I talked about that at great length yesterday. And the point I want to make in continuing the discussion today is that this process, as we are witnessing now, and we have witnessed in many, many years, it points up, I think, the limitations of the two-party system. What do I mean by that? It means that we have this duality, the duopoly, is in charge of this process, fully in charge of the process. And we, the people, have no real way to control what goes on. And that is supposed to be the very center of the democratic process. The budget should be a very democratic process. But if we don't have access, we therefore are locked out, and it therefore becomes undemocratic. No matter how they define it as being, you know, the role for Congress. Well, yeah, we know we have people in the Senate and people in the House, but they're not acting right. These budget endeavors are very, very undemocratic. It's wrong. It's illegal. It's corrupt. And we see over and over again the open corruption that's going on. We can't do anything about it because who do we complain to? We have to complain to somebody who belongs to one wing or the other of a political party. So if the idea is that we are a democratic society, why do we have all of these responsibilities being the exclusive domain of two political parties? And if we have two political parties that are basically in charge of making all these decisions and giving us the burden to bear the burden of the debt, and to bear the burden of all these illicit deals that are being made, then it means that it becomes, by definition, it is a political act. It's an act that comes out of one political party or the other. And that's just all they have to worry about. They don't have to worry about anything else. We do not have an intervening lever to pull. We don't have anything. We don't have a third party or third parties, period. We don't have lobbying groups who lobby for us. We don't have something that allows us access to the levers that are being pulled right and left. We don't have that. And this is one of the major limitation. This is a major limitation, I think. And one of the reasons that we need to really get on the case with so-called third parties that have come into existence and that should be playing the role of, you know, representing genuine democracy. We don't have that. And it seems as if that's what the third parties themselves, they're content with just being on the periphery. In this budget process, we should have vigorous objection, vigorous input and participation by the Green Party, by other parties that have come forward as a movement, even the newly formed movement by Bernie Sanders and others. This is what we're supposed to do. The process is rigged as it is. But we still don't see an aggressive movement by third-party interests to broker some kind of a deal here. I mean, Bernie Sanders got a lot of votes, got 13 million and more, because, as you know, the system was rigged against him. But he got millions of votes. And yet, those votes are now incorporated into the corruption of the Democratic Party. Other movements, their votes have gone to the Republican Party. So we're still talking about a two-party system. We have not yet seen the movement of third parties beyond, you know, getting on the ballot and getting some votes, but completely absenting themselves from this budgetary process. This is where Bernie Sanders needs to shine. This is where the Green Party needs to shine. But they just remove themselves from the process, which in effect is giving the Democratic Party, because that's where they would lean anyway. We had Jill Stein fronting, if you remember, fronting for Hillary Clinton, demanding a recount. Only recently has she admitted, in fact, that the money was Hillary Clinton's money. It was a request of Hillary Clinton, and Stein ended up fronting this recall movement. Very embarrassing for the Green Party. So everywhere we see compromises going on, And in situations where there is at least a speck of hope that they could capitalize on the votes cast, I know they didn't win, but there it was a movement that scored a great victory in that Bernie Sanders did get a respectable turnout. I mean, looking at it in perspective. Millions of votes you don't just set aside until the next time you run for president. That is to be the catalyst for change. That is your currency. You've been given some currency. The Green Party got some votes, not nearly the number of votes that it should have gotten. But of course, we know the reasons. It didn't do a good job of running the election. But in any event, it had votes. Well, why are these votes not leveraged into some kind of a hedge against the dominance of the duopoly when it comes to the budget? Where is the alternative budget from the Green Party and from the Sanders movement? Where is the alternative? They're quiet. And Sanders fully has now gone back into the Democratic Party, despite the fact of all the things that they did to him. You still got millions of votes. And if your hand is strengthened to maintain a presence in the budget process separate from the Democratic Party. But this is the anomaly that we have, that the budget process basically has been commandeered by political parties and not political movements. This is a major problem. No matter what you do, it has to come within that matrix. It's either Democrat or Republican. But we saw, I'm pointing this out because this is something that needs to be corrected, and we have to insist that they correct it. There is no reason, when the budget process is ongoing, there's no reason that it should just be confined to the Democrats or Republicans. We elect, at least theoretically, we elect people to represent us, not any party. But we are so comfortable now thinking that that's the way it ought to be. We elect people to represent us, but we have to concede our power and authority that we invested in individuals like Sanders, like Stein. They now are part of the Democratic fold, essentially. There's no independent movement wielding any particular amount of power in this very, very vital process. All these years, that's how it's been done, as if that's right. It's not right. In Britain, for example, you don't have the Labour Party acting as, you know, a separate unit. I mean, as a part of the integrated unit, they are the Labour Party. But you don't elect the Labour Party to public policy and to economic policy and foreign policy. The party itself is quite separate from that. The party is the agency through which a political movement is galvanized. That movement informs people in Parliament who identify strongly with a particular political philosophy, you see. But here in the United States, you have to be elected as a member of a party, not as a member of a movement. And so even when you have gained traction as a movement, you are co-opted because or cast aside or presumed to be affiliated with a party anyway, if you get my meaning. I'm saying in this budget process, where we have both Democrats and Republicans, and that's it, if in the course of elections you happen to, let's say, you happen to prefer Bernie Sanders, and your vote goes to Bernie Sanders, the understanding is that you are going with Bernie Sanders because you see the movement behind him as representing your interests as well. He doesn't have a party. But theoretically, he shouldn't need a party to be part of this process, to say, and in as much as a party is needed, he of necessity now has to take all those millions of votes, at least this is what he opts to do, all those millions of votes cast with him as a movement separate from the Democratic Party, now become part of the leverage of the Democratic Party against the Republicans in a very corrupt process. You see? So we lose. And I'm asking, why? Why is it that these movements so readily concede, they collapse, they fold, and they lend all those votes that were independent of the party? This is the motivation. When people cast their votes for Bernie Sanders, they're very clear that this is not a vote for the Democrats. But anyway, it ends up being part of the Democratic Party process, budget process, which is a process of exclusion. Practically nothing that Sanders represented, practically nothing that the Green Party, Jill Stein, represented, is part of this budget process. You see? So now we come to this crossroads where we have to make a decision, and we have to confront them about that. Here's a budget that will saddle all Americans, irrespective of political philosophy and party affiliation, with a humongous budget, which is one thing, but with policies attached to this budget that are completely contradictory to the reason that people are voting for them, but they're absent from the process. And they don't seem to be upset about it. They fold into the very corrupt nature of the process and concede authority to a very corrupt party and a very corrupt system. I hope I'm making this clear. This is the conundrum here. If you got 13 million votes, independent of the Democratic Party's architecture, you got 13 plus million, more than that, votes. Right? Jesse Jackson got 11 million votes in the primary in 1984, and he ran again in 1988. Millions of votes generated there. Immediately absorbed into the Democratic Party. In fact, he gleefully offered it to them. He turned over the independent votes to a corrupt party. And there is nothing to show for that, especially in terms of budget priorities. In exchange for the 11 million that Jackson generated, and more, in exchange for the 13 million that Sanford, was gotten by this independent movement. Why then do we not see a reflection of what you fought for or what people voted for you for in the budget? Sanders hasn't really succeeded at that. He hasn't succeeded. Jill Stein hasn't succeeded. So it's not just that the budget is being passed and it's a rotten budget and it's corrupt. It is that even the small independent little island that we created by supporting Bernie Sanders or supporting Jill Stein and the Green Party, or even the Working Families Party, I'm talking about all these other parties other than the duopoly, their priorities that millions of Americans identified with and supported are not reflected in the budget because these parties have opted out of the process. They're not part of this process, and that's by their own volition. And we have to confront them with that. It seems to me, and this was a good opportunity to do it, even if you didn't have zillions of votes, it seems to me a coalition of effort would certainly have helped. If Sanders had said, you know what, I'm done with this crap. I'm an independent, which is what he was, right? He was an independent. I'm taking my votes and I'm putting it with the Working Families Party. I'm putting it with the Green Party. We're all coming together as a coalition effort. And what we are going to do is insist on a place at the table during the budgetary process and that priorities are met. They have similar priorities. No, they back out and refuse to literally harness the power that they were given. Sure, it didn't come up to the level of power that either of the main parties have gotten, but they're running this thing. But that doesn't mean you have no power. You have power. And they just refused or neglected to actualize it. And this is a problem. And they're responsible. They are accountable for this. So you see, I'm not worrying about the main parties and what they're doing and the craziness that they do. They have been doing this for a very long time. Both parties are equally odious to me. And they're committing this kind of undemocratic order, if I could use those two words together. They're being very undemocratic and openly corrupt. And still, the little bit of power that people have given these smaller parties, and it's not insignificant in my view. Bernie Sanders had been given a lot of encouragement to go up against the parties. Jill Stein may not have brought in a record number of votes. In fact, I took the Green Party to task, as you recall. But they're now both playing, with this rotten system. They're both yielding to it instead of harnessing that power, flexing that power independently of the Democratic Party, to which they would find themselves far more compatible than with the Republican Party. But the fact is, I am interpreting, and you will tell me whether this makes sense as an analysis or not. You know, send me a note at leadstories@gmail.com. We still don't have our phones up yet, but it's going to be happening this week. We'll get them installed and so forth. It's an intricate process, but that will be done by the end of the week. But listen to what I'm saying and tell me that this doesn't make sense. What is preventing Sanders from bolting from this process and saying, well, you guys haven't put on the table, or you haven't included in your fancy budget, your corrupt budget, A, B, C, D, and E. And my movement, which is backing me, is not going along with this. We have different ideas. And you force the Democratic Party and you force the Republican Party to pay attention to the other Americans. That's us. We're not part of this process. We only get told what the budget is. It's $1.5 trillion extra that people will have to pay for. And that $1.5 million would subsidize the oligarchy. Fine. We know that. I'm not worrying about them. I'm worrying about the fact that we have some kind of power. It's not nearly what it ought to be, but it does exist. And it was legitimized in the last election. People chose not to vote for the Democrats. They chose not to vote for the Republicans. They chose to vote for independent parties as well. And those people have a duty, I would argue. They have a duty to represent those people who made that investment in them. They have a duty to have ready their own budget. They have a duty to compel the system to respect it, to honor it, and in fact to include both your budgetary items and your vision. You're part of America. That's why they voted for you. How come you're laying down and letting them walk all over you? In fact, ignore you completely. And that's why I am so critical of these movements and these new parties and so forth. They don't understand that this is part of their job. Their job is to have alternatives to everything that the major parties are doing. They're constructing a new budget. You should have your version of a budget. The people's budget. Look, we know, as I've said, that a huge percentage of the American budget, as enacted by the duopoly, it's inspired or compelled by lobbyists, by special interest groups. We're a special interest group. We don't identify with the Republicans. We don't identify with the Democrats. But we are a viable group. No, we don't have the same number of votes and so forth. We don't have a history of longevity in the world of politics that these main parties have. But you cannot just ignore the fact that millions of people have put their faith in you. They defied the inclination to just say, well, if we're down to two major parties, I'll pick the Democrats. No, they defied all of that. And they decided, I am making my political investment with Sanders, or with the Green Party, or with the Working Families Party, or whatever party outside of the duopoly. And that means that these parties and movements and independent political efforts, they have an obligation to function still outside of the political season, because, you know, people would see them come alive again in the next election, and then they go dormant, as if there's nothing really to oppose the Democratic Party in particular about, and the Republicans. You still exist. You're still carrying that investment that people made in you. You have an obligation to present an alternative budget. You have an obligation to be at the table. You have an obligation to insist that this undemocratic process stop. You have an obligation to demand recognition. Now, it may be that I'm just way out of my league here. Maybe I'm way out on a limb on this one, philosophically. But I have always felt this way. And I have always criticized independent movements of believing that their only job is to come alive at election time and to suffer the indignity of traumatic losses, but not understanding that people, millions of people, still are looking to you to stand up for them. And as much as you presented yourselves as a healthy alternative to what we have been experiencing as politics in this country, it's not one of those things that ends after the election ends. You have to be on point. This is a very important process. I have not seen an analysis by any of these movements as to where this budget is going way to hell, where it is endangering the people that you represented in this last election. I haven't seen an alternative budget. I haven't seen a direct confrontation with this process, an open confrontation with this process, and agitating for change, that this cannot continue. That the people are locked out, and we have the inmates running the asylum, playing with our lives and our money. It's got to stop. And these movements, the one thing they can do that would forever change the political landscape is insisting that they are viable. People have participated in the voting process, millions by the millions. And if you, as I said, if you form a coalition of these parties at this time to challenge the budget and to challenge the process, you're talking millions, tens of millions of people. We can't have these movements fall apart and fall down and fade away, or just run for the tall grass and think that, well, we'll come alive again and, you know, hopefully we get more votes. You have votes now. You have millions of votes now. What are you doing with it in terms of just facing down this horrible administration and this corrupt process? Well, that's generally where I wanted to go today to finish off the discussion from yesterday. And we have to do something else, and I will mention that, and that is we have to reorganize or organize ourselves. There was no accident. I deliberately shared with you the instruction of Kwame Ture. And this is last week, talking about the importance of organization of the people. We are not organized. And that includes the parties and the movements that are coming forward. Hopefully more will. But the intention should be about organizing communities and introducing them to the idea that not only do they have political power, but they are compelled to express it for change. They have to do that. But our communities are not organized. And we're following the rotten pattern, especially of the Democrats, who give no respect at all to their constituencies. Don't go down that road. Let's see if we could persuade these independent movements to understand how vitally important they are and how they have missed the mark here. We might be inclined to kind of forgive them, but we can't continue to forgive them. They've got to step up. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can let me know what you're thinking. By Friday, hopefully, we should have our phones back up and we can talk a lot about the subjects I've raised here. Now, see you tomorrow, and thank you again for listening today.